potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Priscilla, Naiad, Rustin, Upload Season 3, and a look back at Fright Night. Oh, did you think I was going to stop talking about horror movies just because Halloween's in our rearview mirror? No, I'm going to go through a bunch of movies over the next couple weeks that I watched during the Halloween season just because I want to revisit them, and I watched a lot of horror movies. Hey, I'm a fan, we assume. But I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Five Nights at Freddy's crushed it. And this is what's so amazing about Five Nights at Freddy's. It made $80 million over the weekend. That broke a whole bunch of records, first of all, because it was the highest opening of any movie on Halloween weekend. It's also the highest opening from a Blumhouse movie, even topping the 2018 Halloween reboot, which was $76 million. And it was the largest opening of all time of a Blumhouse movie on anything. And the worldwide take was an extra $50-some million on top of it. They were thinking it was only going to make $50 million this weekend in the States, and it almost made twice that. It was the highest opening for a PG-13 horror movie. And the last one was Mummy Returns, which was $68 million. It's the second highest opening weekend for a video game adaptation, of course, following behind the huge Super Mario Brothers movies opening earlier this year. This is extra impressive when you realize it was also on Peacock. This was a day-and-date streaming thing. It made the same amount in theaters that Black Widow did when it had a hybrid release. And then, now granted, when Black Widow came out, you had to pay for it on a premium on Disney Plus, but you didn't have to go to the theater to see it. And for all the people out there who have been complaining about hybrid releases and you're leaving money on the table when you do that, it didn't matter. And the reality is, what you have to realize is it's like any performance of any film, it depends on the film and it depends on the audience. And you cannot just assume it was going to make money because your little idea of how movies should be released wasn't followed in this one. This blows the lid off the theory that doing a hybrid release would kill the box office. And this is for millennials and Gen Z people. These are people who watch shows on their phone. These are people who don't own a television. They watch it on their computer and on their phone when they're going to sleep. So, yeah, if you have something that makes people want to go experience it in the theaters, they're going to go see it. And then they might watch it at home. Like, one of my sons went to go see it in the theater, and another one of my sons watched it on Peacock. This is just how it works. So, yeah, that's a huge number. Now, the next in line was Taylor Swift. It came in, it was way lower than that because, you know, it had been out for a couple weeks. And then Killers of the Flower Moon. What's interesting is Nightmare Before Christmas dropped a little bit, but it stayed in the seventh position, so it was still in the top 10. The next piece of news I want to talk about is Snow White's been delayed. It's been delayed to 2025. And here's the thing that I find so confounding about this movie. There are people who they're just wanting it to fail. And I think part of it is because, and I don't even think it's Disney's fault. It's some pundits out there that had, and let's face it, Ron DeSantis has gone to war with Disney very publicly and politically. And you do that to anything, you're going to polarize your audience. You're going to get people who want to then boycott Disney because it's all the woke mind virus and all that stuff. And then they're going after Rachel Zegler. And I've talked about that. Leave her alone. All these decisions that are being made about Snow White, she is not making those decisions. These decisions are way above her pay grade. She is just a hired actress. And then they release this new image from the movie this week, and they have CGI dwarfs. And now I'm seeing people go, no, they're having crappy CGI. I'm like, well, look, You got to choose something. They're either going to do live action dwarfs or live action mixture of people. No matter what you do, people are going to be PO'd about it. Just, oh my God, it's a Snow White movie, for crying out loud. Just watch the movie and quit trying to make everything political about everything. For the people who complain that all movies are everything's getting political, they're the ones who are making movies political. Good Lord, just go see a movie. Yes, the 1937 version of Snow White was antiquated, and it had old customs, and it had old views of what a woman's place in society. We are 80 years away from that. There is nothing wrong with updating a story to make it a little more modern. Good Lord, grow up, people. Anyways, it's less than 3 weeks until Thanksgiving, if you don't know. And so November is going to go very, very fast. So happy Movember, happy Noirvember, happy NaNoWriMo for National Novel Writing Month, and welcome the turkeys. I'm going to be watching some bad movies, deliberately bad movies, Mystery Science Theater level movies this month. That's what I do in November. So you'll hear some of those coming up in the next couple weeks. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Good Burger 2, which is coming to Paramount Plus on November 22nd.
Buckle up! The new adventures of Ed and Dex starts now!
You think I can get a job at Good Burger?
I'm putting a good word to Mr. Gist. That's not soap, by the way. It's maple syrup.
Why?
Are you using a plunger to unclog the shake machine, as in the same plunger we use to unclog the toilet?
No. Welcome to Good Burger. Can I take your order?
Whoa. Megacorp wants to replace everybody with robots. We gotta do something.
Look, I'm gonna say I have no skin in this game at all. I've never seen Good Burger. I remember when it came out. It was sometime in the 90s. I was in college. I was not the age that was gonna be going to see Good Burger. I might go back and watch it, because I'm assuming it's going to be on Paramount, the original. This one looks just silly. I mean, I don't know if this is an authentic version of Good Burger. I mean, they bring back Keenan and Kel. I guess that's a good thing. So it's, hopefully it's better than that House Party reboot that they did, because that House Party reboot was terrible, and the original House Party movies were fine, or at least the first one was. And this looks funny. I mean, it's a kid's movie. It's a Nickelodeon-made film. So, yeah, I'll check this one out. So we'll talk about that around Thanksgiving in less than 3 weeks. The next one I want to talk about is Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which is coming to theaters Memorial Day weekend.
When I sleep, I see strange things.
Memories?
Not memories. I see everything.
That is not everything.
I'm a huge fan of not just the Planet of the Apes series, but the reboots, the new Planet of the Apes. And yeah, if you go back and watch Rise of the Planet of the Apes, I mean, as good as the special effects was in 2011... You know, they some of them have aged better than others, and they were still dealing with that photorealism, uncanny valley. But it still looks pretty good, and I gotta go back. I'm gonna go back and watch probably watch all the Planet of the Apes movies, going all the way back to the 60s. And those original ones, they have their ups and downs. I'm not as big of a fan of the original Planet of the Apes as I am of some of the later ones, like Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is one that actually. They draw a lot of the story from Rise of the Planet of the Apes from. Those are really fun movies. I mean, they're steeped in the 70s, but they're fun to watch. And then you can throw that Tim Burton version in there as well. But then you watch these new ones, and I really liked Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was okay. But then I thought War for the Planet of the Apes was really good. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the biopics, Naiad and Rustin. Those are names.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I have pointed out we are now past Halloween, and that means it's award season. That means they're starting to drop the big movies that they're hoping to win awards. I don't know exactly what's going to happen with the award ceremonies coming up because the actor strike's still going on. I think we are far enough out that I think it's very likely they're going to come to an agreement before the end of the year for the actor strike. And so I don't think there's any necessity to push the Oscars out of the end of January, early February timeframe and put it into April like they did a couple years ago during COVID. But you never quite know. But they are ramping up, and we got the award season. We got the movies coming out. Netflix is becoming very aggressive with its award season. A lot of the other studios are a little bit, they don't know quite what to do, because when you have an award film, you want the actors to promote it. That's what you're literally actively trying to get people nominated for Oscars. Netflix is just pushing ahead, even if they don't have their actors to it, because they've got a pipeline that they have to fill, and all this stuff goes on to their service. So these two movies are actually Netflix movies. And Netflix, the way they do their releases, they throw it in theaters for a couple weeks. That gives it a qualifying run. I believe, like Rustin, which I'll be talking about later, that one is in limited release this week. And in 2 weeks, it'll be on Netflix. Naiad's been in limited release for the last 2 weeks, so it is available now on Netflix. So let's start with that one. Long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad attempts to swim from Cuba to Florida in her 60s.
Diana Nyad, world champion marathon swimmer.
The swim I want to do is 60 hours. That's Cuba to Florida.
Absolutely not. No, that's insane.
Diana, you tried that when you were 28, and you did not make it when you're 28. You're 60.
I don't believe in imposed limitations.
The only one who gets to decide if I'm through is me.
It's 100 miles or 60 hours of constant swimming.
Biopics, there's a difference between one that's meant to be beginning to the end of life, Walk the Line or Ray. Those were biopics that start with their childhood and go to pretty much the end of their life. And then there's sort of like what I'd say would be more of a limited biopic, which is what Nyad is. Nyad is not about Diana Nyad's life, because it all takes place mainly when she is in her 60s. She was a famous, as famous as you can get as a swimmer. She was a long distance swimmer, which means she would swim dozens and dozens of miles in open ocean. You know, we're talking like the swimming the English Channel. And sometimes you're talking about doing it for more than 24 hours, which, you know, look, I like splashing around in a pool now and then, but you know, that's a lot of time to spend in the water. And of course, if you're in the open ocean, you've got sharks and jellyfish and just general weather conditions that are the problem. And she had tried this when she was in her 20s and did not succeed. And I'm not going to say she failed, because this is not an easy task. They're talking 100 miles in open ocean to get from Cuba to Florida. And I am all for the human spirit and get behind the character in this one. I don't think Diana Nyad is that congenial of a person, because Annette Bening plays her, and she does not play her very congenial. And it felt like they were trying to give a realistic portrayal of how Diana Nyad is personally, not as a public figure, but as a personal relationship. And she's got a friend played by Jodie Foster who looks like Bono. And Jodie Foster is the best thing in this movie. She does a great job acting. She's very grounded, and she is the emotional support. I'm not a huge fan of Annette Bening. It just seems like the last 10 years have been her just trying to win an award. Every year there is some Annette Bening award film, and this is this year's Annette Bening award film that we got to watch. She comes off as pretentious to me. She's off-putting. And then you put her in a character like Diana Nyad, who is arrogant and self-centered and egotistical, and then it becomes very hard for me to watch. And I just started rooting against, I started rooting for the sharks and the jellyfish in this movie, because I just was so annoyed with her character. She was just insufferable. And I'm like, God, everybody's rallying around you, and you're doing this stuff, and you're taking advantage of these people. And I know that's kind of how these things work. There's always that one person that's the focus, and then you have your support staff. Unfortunately, that is how the world works. But at a certain point, I was just like, I don't care if you make it to Cuba or not. I mean, there were good performances, but, you know, good performances were not enough to alleviate my frustrations with the characters and their inequitable obsessions. I mean, this is Diana Nyad's obsession, and everybody else's wants and desires are irrelevant. And I mean, like, yeah, he gives that sort of triumph of the human spirit story, but at what cost, at least is my thought. So I wasn't a huge fan. I'm going to say that Nyad kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Rustin. This biopic focuses on the civil rights leader Bayard Rustin, his tumultuous life, and his work in organizing the March on Washington.
In 41, you called for a large-scale march. The time has come for another. I can handle all the grunt work. Rally the young. We are going to put together the largest peaceful protest made up of angelic troublemakers such as yourselves.
My friend, Dr. Martin Luther King, will be joining us.
How many bodies did it take to surround the White House?
How many? Sorry, I thought that was a setup for a joke. You literally want me to find out?
So I've never heard of Bayard Rustin, and that's to my detriment. I mean, I'm not well-versed in the civil rights movement, but a lot of people know the March on Washington. I mean, that's an incredibly famous march. What this is it's about the people who organized it and the people who, and what they had to leverage and how they had to deal with things and what it was like to be black in the 60s and to be an activist, which really put a target on your back. And yeah, Martin Luther King's in the movie. The character's in the movie, but he is a side character. He has a couple scenes. But it's not a Martin Luther King movie. It's about Rustin. It's about this guy who, just through sheer force of will, was able to do stuff. And you don't realize, especially now, almost 60 years later, you know, I don't know how hard it would be to organize something like that. I imagine it might be easier now because there's a better support system. But imagine trying to bring in, you know, a couple hundred thousand people into Washington, D.C. and feed them and have toilet facilities for them and clean up after yourselves and have crowd control so you don't have any people who are just rowdy or whatever, you know, just in small numbers, and you want it to be a peaceful protest. I mean, this was a massive undertaking for everybody putting this march together. And yeah, all the eyes were on Martin Luther King. But there were people who really had to work to make this happen. And so that I found very eye-opening. And it's a well-made story, and it tells the struggle that Rustin had because he was a gay black man in America in the 1960s, which was not too popular back then, and struggling with his own history and his own sexuality. And he was open about it, but then also he couldn't be too open about it. So I think it also has this weird little place in queer cinema because it deals with the issues that he had because everything's all entangled. And I don't think they get in the way of each other because this is just this guy trying to do his job. And I thought it was a really well done movie. I mean, this is well-meaning and well-acted film. It shines a necessary spotlight on the behind the scenes of a movement and an event that most people don't know how it was organized. So I'm going to have to say that Rustin rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Priscilla and Upload Season 3. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. Let's continue on with the biopics. This biopic is about Priscilla Presley. It's called Priscilla. Sofia Coppola directs this intimate look at Priscilla Presley and her relationship with Elvis.
What are the kids listening to these days?
Bobby, Darren, Fabian, and you.
Just what is the intent here, Mr. Presley? You got women throwing themselves at you. Why my daughter?
Well, sir, I happen to be very fond of your daughter. You don't have to worry about her.
He's not like you imagine.
Well, I need a woman who understands that things like this might happen. Are you going to be here or not?
You can't talk about this without at least acknowledging Baz Luhrmann's Elvis movie from last year. And as much as everyone loved that movie, this one kind of makes you stop and go, well, yeah, there were some problems with him. then this is not unknown stuff. I mean, this is based on Priscilla Presley's memoir from like 1985. So, I mean, this stuff's been sitting around on the shelf for 40 years. People know this. These are not secrets, but there's stuff that's always glossed over. And even though, you know, Elvis, the movie as a biopic last year, it showed his problems. It showed his drug abuse. It showed his womanizing. It showed his dysfunctional relationship with Priscilla. But it was always done as saying, but it was Elvis. We love Elvis. And he was such a good performer. He was just so good to watch on stage. Comparing the two films is a great insight into America and just people's, but American views of celebrities. The people who are like, I can forgive you doing a whole bunch of things just as long as you entertain me. Get up there, you jester. You know? And that's kind of what I feel about Elvis after watching this movie. I mean, I like Elvis's music, but he was kind of a man-child. I mean, and that happens with anybody. You throw enough money and fame and sexual magnetism and charisma at somebody, especially in their 20s, and you're going to get somebody who's not a great person. And you've got like the Memphis Mafia out there as your supports and a whole group of Ed McMahons behind you laughing at your jokes. So watching Priscilla, it's a polar opposite, not just in terms of how it handles the relationship and how it handles the celebrity of Elvis and Priscilla, because she was a bit of a celebrity back then just because she was Mrs. Elvis Presley. It's also the tone so different. Baz Luhrmann is so bright and flashy, and Sofia Coppola is so muted and slow burn. And the other thing I find real interesting about Sofia Coppola is she does a lot of movies about women trapped in their own privilege. Sometimes in this bubble of fame. Because that's what Marie Antoinette's like. And that's what The Bling Ring is, essentially. It's a sympathetic look at people who misbehaved not because of poverty, but because they're bored in their bubble of privilege. And that tracks because, I mean, she was born into the Coppola. She's got a very famous father, and I'll bet you she wanted for nothing as a kid because they had plenty of money. So she was in, but she then had to emerge her own way out of that. And that's really what this movie's about. And it's Kaylee Spaney who plays Priscilla. She does a great job because she plays that innocent 14-year-old at the beginning. Yes, she was 14 when Elvis went after her. And that's creepy. I'm sorry. I'm just going to put it out there. That's predatory and creepy. And if you watch the movie and you see how he sends his people out to him, for everybody out there yelling groomers, this is where it really happens. Where you got somebody who has influence and power and they like somebody who's criminally younger than them. Yet they're able to manipulate the situation with money and fame, influence or power. And that's what happens here. And really, it's like, I mean, she never got a chance to be a person before she became Elvis's plaything. And yeah, you get a look into how he never really got developed as a responsible person because he grew up being controlled himself. He, you know, Colonel Parker was very controlling on him. And then he just passed that along to Priscilla. He controlled her every minute of the day, even when he was out of town. So it does not show Elvis in a good light, but I feel it's authentic. I know Lisa Marie didn't like the script. You know, she read it before she passed away, but Lisa Marie was a baby when this stuff was going on. So what the heck does she know? She wasn't even born when I consider the most skeezy things that Elvis did with her. It's a really interesting look. And the whole thing is they take all the fame. There's only one or two shots of Elvis actually performing or him in a concert. They show him at home. They don't show him as an icon. They don't show him as a public figure. They show him as a person at home and what she had to deal with whatever he said went because he had the money. I don't know. It's very on brand for Sofia Coppola. This low-key drama looks at a woman trapped in privilege with an undercurrent of dread. And it really works because you feel trapped with her, and it's very well done. Its cinematography's a little dark. I hate that crap. But I can forgive it because I think it's a well-done movie. I'm going to say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I want to talk about Upload Season 3. This started dropping in October, sometime like around the 20th. They drop like one or two episodes a week. So I wanted to cover this because I've watched the first two seasons. I said, why not? It's in there. Let's talk about it. Apparently, it's Prime's number one comedy, original. So after Nate downloads into a new body, he goes on the run with Nora in an attempt to take down Horizon.
Did you guys hook up? Was it everything you thought it would be? She seems like a bit of a pillow princess.
Let's just say we had an amazing connection.
How long have you been downloaded?
26 days.
So what are you doing here?
Freyon's killed hundreds of innocent people.
We're gonna break in and shut it down.
I have a plan.
Promise me you won't say anything. The more people that know about it, the more dangerous it is.
No. He's nowhere in the system.
So
I rebooted him from a backup copy.
There is another you living in Lakeview.
You think this is identity theft?
I find it so funny because Greg Daniels created this show and he used to work on The Office. And my big issues with this show, and it's gotten worse as the seasons go on, they have moments where they really sort of tap into something very interesting, especially from a speculative fiction standpoint, because this is about recreating consciousness and where's the soul and what happens to people. And they have this whole subplot in this season about the AI, the non-playing characters that are AI-generated things, giving them sort of an awareness, which I think, I mean, that's like tackling some really interesting stuff about identity and what is a copy and what is authentic. And then the show, once it starts to tap into that, it gets scared and it's like, I'm going to make a fart joke. And then it gets into the goofiness and absurdity. And I know you're sitting there going, oh, Kevin, lay off. It's a comedy. Okay, let me tell you something else. Another guy who worked on The Office, Michael Schur, I think is his name. He did the series The Good Place, which is a brilliant series and very funny. And it never loses its funniness. But it also tackles some huge issues and some, you know, I mean, it's literally about life and death and existence and the soul and religion and existentialism. There's a lot that The Good Place tackles and still makes jokes. If you can take a character like Jason Mendoza from The Good Place and explore what it means to be alive, you should be able to do the same thing with Upload. But Uploads, it's conflicted. It's trying to do two different things. It's trying to play around with some of these ideas. The other thing is, a good chunk of this takes place in the real world because Nate's downloaded into a clone body. And so it's less interesting. But every time you get into the virtual world, it's just like, oh, we're going to make body humor. Fart, ha, ha, ha. And I'm just like, oh, my God. And I like a good fart joke as much as anybody else does. I'm a child at heart. But, I mean, there are two shows fighting in here. One that offers a real look at human issues, and one that just wants to make fart jokes. I wish it would figure itself out. Go one way or the other, or find a way to do both. But the way they're doing it now is conflicting and problematic. And it's frustrating, because every time they swerve close to something, I'm like, oh, now this is suddenly getting into, oh, nope, they're doing a joke. You should be able to tell the jokes within that parameters. I think it's just not as well written as something like The Good Place. And I know I'm holding it up to a higher standard, but if they were able to do it on one show, you should be able to do it on another. So, I mean, still, it's entertaining enough. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Fright Night and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on and finish up the movie reviews. And I'm going to be doing some cleanup from Halloween. Of course, everybody who knows me knows I'm a huge fan of horror movies. And over the course of, well, it used to be just October, but I just made it September and October. Because look, if you can start doing Christmas music in November, you can start doing Halloween movies and scary movies and horror movies in September. One of the movies that I revisited this year was Fright Night, the original one from 1985, directed by Tom Holland. No, not Spider-Man. Different Tom Holland. He's responsible for the Child's Play movies with Chucky, you know, the Chucky doll. So I thought I'd go back to Fright Night. I remember seeing it. I was like 14 and maybe 13. I don't know if I turned 14 yet that year. But in Fright Night, this 1985 film follows a high schooler who believes a vampire has moved in next door.
What would you do if you accidentally discovered the house next door was occupied by something not human? No one believes you.
Mom, I didn't have a nightmare.
Not your mom.
They did kill a girl over there.
Not your girlfriend.
Charlie, is this some sort of a trick?
It knows that you know. You'll do anything to protect yourself. But it will do anything to protect its secret.
Now, I know I talked about this, and I want to revisit it, because it's one of my favorite vampire movies. And one of the reasons why I like it, I mean, let's just talk about the very surface level as a teenager in the 80s watching this. It was a bona fide horror movie. It had vampires killing people. It had blood. It had nudity. It had violence. You know, it had all the R-rated elements you'd expect from the 80s. It was before PG. I mean, PG-13 started actually that year. I think it was 1985 that the PG-13 rating started. But they weren't trying to make horror movies PG-13. You'd get a horror movie, and this was the era of the slasher movie, so they'd make them R-rated. And I remember just dying to see this movie. At the same time, I had read the book Salem's Lot by Stephen King around that time, and there was a lot of connective tissue between the two. I don't even think it was meant to be there, because both Fright Night and Salem's Lot are, they're inspired by Dracula. You know, this mysterious vampire who you actually don't see right away moves into town, and the people who live there have to deal with it. And so there's a lot of the tropes that you see in the original Dracula. I mean, the book by Bram Stoker and the movie with Bela Lugosi, but really the book by Bram Stoker. And then Salem's Lot, Stephen King wove a lot of that in there. It was still about the destruction of a small town and how, something can happen, like the building of a highway can siphon off the energy of a small town and have it die. The vampire represented the change in that movie. In this one, it had the same thing of this guy coming from the old world. There's a trope about this long-lost love. And so Amanda Bierce, and she was early 20s or whatever, long before she did Married with Children, she was the girlfriend in this one. And this has all the authentic elements of a vampire story. And long before either Stephanie Meyer ruined vampires for decades, or even Anne Rice, before she made a mopey metrosexuals pining over the fact that they live forever, this is when vampires were scary and violent. And this movie brings that out. But it's also very funny. It has that camp of the 80s, which makes a lot of films from the 80s a pleasure to watch. And especially, I grew up with that. So, I mean, I guess if you're a millennial, yeah, maybe you don't care. If you're a Zoomer, you don't care. But to me watching Fright Night in 1985 was like my father watching the Dracula, Frankenstein, and Wolfman movies in the 40s. So this is one of the best modern vampire stories that balances camp with classic horror tropes. I really enjoyed it. I found it on AMC Plus. It didn't have commercial breaks, but it'd do this weird thing where it'd fade to black and fade back up. And you knew that's when there would be a commercial break. But it's unedited. It was on AMC Plus. And that was a lot of fun. So I'm going to have to say, I love Fright Night. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on what I've had my eye on for a little more than a year, because it made news last year when it was in production, and that is Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. Let me just do the trailer and everything, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. After being abandoned by Christopher Robin years ago, the now feral Winnie the Pooh and Piglet violently attack anyone who enters the Hundred Acre Wood.
We're not going to find them.
We will. Pooh, Piglet, Eeyore, we were friends for many years.
Christopher, we need to leave. Now.
I really need to find out what's happened here, okay?
We need to go. There's... The flower is dead. There's someone else outside.
We used to be friends. Why are you doing this, please? I would have never left, I swear. I swear.
All right, the history behind this movie is the character of Winnie the Pooh went into public domain recently. And so somebody's like, ooh, let's do this. Now Disney has the Winnie the Pooh with the red shirt and the actual imagery that they have. That's trademarked by Disney. But the original A.A. Milne stories went into public domain. So this person's like, yeah, let's make a horror movie based on it. It's not uncommon to have a horror movie based on, you know, some sort of childhood thing. I mean, clowns are a great example. I mean, clowns make great horror tropes. Dolls make great horror tropes. The other thing that's happening right now is you're getting these horror movies based on children's stuff, like Mary Had a Little Lamb. There's a Mary Had a Little Lamb horror movie out. There's a Grinch movie out that's about the Grinch being, I think it's called You're a Mean One or something like that. So this is nothing new, and it's sort of trying to play off some fame there. And it got very notorious. It also made news recently because some idiot at a charter school in Florida decided they call him a professor. I doubt he has a doctorate, but they call him professor at that school. This guy showed Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey to his, like, what, fourth grade class? And look, when I was a kid, I would have loved to see Blood and Honey when I was in fourth grade. But not every fourth grader should be seeing this, and certainly not without the permission of their parents. It's not rated. I don't think it's even rated R, but it's unrated. And within the first half hour, they put a character through a wood chipper. So this is not a sweet, cuddly little movie. And I think their kids voted on it. They thought it'd be funny, but nobody wants to see it. I mean, you're not going to show Last House on the Left to children. And it's not the first time somebody's gotten in trouble. There was a person in my hometown in Columbus, Ohio. There was somebody who showed ABCs of Death to a high school kids. And look, I get it. High school kids see horror movies all the time. But if you have like a 15-year-old kid who doesn't like horror movies, they shouldn't have to see that. And they showed it to the class, even though it was very inappropriate. But going back, and I've been wanting to watch this for a while because I'd heard about it. I hear it gets terrible reviews. I can see why. Then not burying the lead there or anything. I mean, I'm all for having fun with something like this. The problem that I had, it has the violence and the horror stuff. It has all the stuff you'd expect from a slasher movie, because that's essentially what it is, even though Winnie the Pooh and Piglet are the killers. It's violent. It's got blood. It's got these graphic kills. It's got nudity. It's got a whole bunch of young 20-something women stuck in a cabin while the killers are coming after them. So it has all that element you'd expect from a slasher movie. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't give any characters. And it's not like we need great characterization for a slasher movie. I mean, most characters in a slasher movie are very, very basic, but it doesn't even have that. It's murky. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense how everybody fits together. This one character has a stalker and you think that the stalker's following, but that just gets abandoned at some point. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And then on top of it, Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, they're just guys in rubber masks. And when you watch the movie, it's hard to tell whether it's actually a person in a mask or that's actually supposed to be what the character looks like. The makeup design is terrible in this. Could you spend just a little more money making them look like they're not just Bubba's in the woods wearing a Pooh Bear and Piglet mask? It was interesting. It's on Peacock. I don't know if it still is, because at the end of October, a lot of the streaming services dumped their horror stuff. But, you know, I wanted to like it. I knew I wouldn't think it was great. I'm giving it a little more points than a lot of other critics, because, I mean, it's not a great movie. It's not innovative. It's not groundbreaking. It took this notorious premise and ran with it. As a slasher, this has the blood and the guts, but it lacks the most rudimentary character basics, like coherent dialogue and passable mask work to rise above the notorious premise. I mean, the point now is that you just have the premise and it's going to trigger people because it's got the childhood character in it, but it's really not that great. They're making a sequel. I don't know. Maybe they put something a little bit better to it. Maybe it'll be like Terrifier 2, where Terrifier 1 wasn't that good, but Terrifier 2 is a little bit better. Anyways, I'm going to say that Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the Marvels and the Holdovers. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.